Thank you, George, for that tour de force, and also for the font of deep hope at the end, which I'm sure we're all grateful for. I would like to just ask you something about a possible source of shallow hope. Shallow, but perhaps meaningful hope. So, you know, in the 60s, late 60s or early 70s, there was a novel that had an arresting title, "Been Down So Long It Feels Like Up to Me." Does that resonate with anybody here? "Been Down So Long It Looks Like Up to Me." It was a hippie favorite. And I wonder if we aren't reaching a place like that. I'm talking about what the sociologist Christian Smith coined as moralistic therapeutic deism, which he said was the faith of most, many, increasing numbers of young people in America today, moralistic therapeutic deism. And we all know what this is. This is the idea that we mustn't be mean, right? Where meanness trumps. And you could call this repaganization. I don't like that post-Christian term because I think that's teleologically prejudicial. But say it's repaganization. Whatever it is, that is the ethos of many people in their 20s, 30s, and many teenagers. And what I'm wondering is whether there might not be a way of latching on to that so that instead of just dismissing it, since it is easily dismissed, whether we might instead get a little mileage out of trying to work with it. This gets back to the point I was making earlier about the charities, the little sisters, etc. It's mean to beat up on Christian charities. It's mean to sue the U.S. bishops as NARAL is suing the U.S. bishops for not providing contraception and abortion at the southern border of the United States where we have refugee camps. It's mean to attack King's College, Gordon College. It's mean to attack Christian homeschooling. And I just wonder if we might not get a little movement out of pushing back against that kind of meanness so that we're working with people's better instincts and trying to move them in a wider direction. Just for comment.
There is a part of me, I'll take that and put a kind of weird spin on it. There's a part of me that actually wishes that we lose Zubik versus Burwell. Because I want to see on the front page of every newspaper in the country and all over the internet, which is where it's going to be seen, my friends at the Little Sisters of the Poor in Washington, whom I know quite well, being led out in leg irons. I want to see that. That might actually focus mine. The way the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma focused minds, the way the Sonogram has been extraordinarily more influential than any of us talking heads in refocusing minds on the life issues. There's a part of me that wants to see that. Now, having said that, I recognize the legal catastrophe that this would impose upon us. And recognizing that makes me hope that we get at least a win of sorts here. Because until, it's not just a question of pushing back, until people start connecting the dots between the fact that they're really not happier than they were 20 or 30 years ago, and this decadence problem, we're going to have to play very good defense simply to keep an institutional base from which we can do the things we have to do. And that's really what's at stake in Zubik versus Burwell. Will not only the Catholic Church, but every other civil society institution in the country be able to maintain itself according to its own self-understanding to do good things? Now, when you reach that critical mass of unhappiness, I don't know, there's obviously a certain, I'm just thinking out loud now, there's a certain critical mass of unhappiness, very evident in the Trumpkins today.
Sanders too,
but there are a lot of young people who, I mean, this is the first time they've gotten a chance to play communist, and, you know, it's, we all did that at one point, and, you know, it works for a while, and then you grow up. But it's the Trump vote that the unhappiness of which I understand, I think, a fair amount of, along all four parts of it that I would describe. But it's the question of why does it attach itself to this guy? I mean, that's the thing. Look, I'm unhappy every morning when I look at the newspaper. You don't really want to be around me in the morning. But that, you know, so it's the attachment to the vulgarian, which suggests to me that we really haven't bottomed out as much as perhaps we need to. Let me turn this in a positive way, though. Many of you have probably read the books of Rodney Stark at Baylor, I think he is now. I say books, there are six or seven of them that are essentially the same argument retold in different ways. And the question is, how did the Christians win? How did this little off-brand ragtag band of people from east of nowhere within 250 years convert what he now estimates to be half the Mediterranean world? Rod Stark's big argument is that Constantine was joining the winning side. That, you know, this thing was on a roll. That's pretty good work for 250 years. How did that happen? And his historical sociological analysis of how it happened is not of great comfort to intellectuals, because he says it wasn't by argument. It was by example. That the Christians modeled a nobler, more humane way of life, find it described in the letter to Diognetus, that was immensely attractive in the world of the film Gladiator, you know, which after all was not 300 BC. Gladiator begins with the death of Marcus Aurelius, which is halfway through the second Christian century. Christianity modeled something nobler, and not simply in martyrs, although martyrs were important. It was nobler in terms of the respect and dignity of women. It was nobler in terms of the understanding of marriage. It was nobler in terms of how you deal with the sick, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's what we have to do. But that's what we're fighting to be able to do in something like Zubik.
I just had a question with respect to the thing that you said about Mary, about being mean. I've read and heard other places where the church has been characterized as the thing that's in the way of the progressive project. And I think that's in many respects, I agree with that. And it seems that a lot of what we call progressives, they have a religion. It's not saying they do have religion, they have their gods, and the church is in the way. And it seems to me that lay Catholics and of every stripe need to prepare themselves, because it's not just about being mean. I think a great deal of what I hear and sense is that they despise God. They, in fact, their gods are themselves. They despise God, they despise Christianity, and it's going to be a little more than being mean. I think we'll see at some point or another the little sisters of the poor in leg irons, and what are we prepared to do as a community of Christians and Catholics to deal with that? I mean, we won't be able, like, as I think the speaker mentioned earlier, you're not going to be getting tenure at Harvard if you're an Orthodox Catholic. You'll not be invited for the second interview. Or you might be excluded from the military, or you're, you can't work at Apple or you can't be the chairman of Mozilla and hold Orthodox Christian views. And, you know, I think that's, I wonder if we're, I certainly don't feel prepared for that kind of thing, but I think, could you comment on, if you think that's actually,
yeah, no, you.
Yes.
If that's a looming thing and maybe that's just the thing that's going to happen.
No, I think that's all true. And the what to do about it part, I will leave to George Weigel, but about that, just about that, I think it's really helpful to distinguish, as I don't think we've distinguished sufficiently, between the people who really are just about the I don't want to be mean, most yeah. especially the younger people, and then the activist wing of secularist progressivism, which behaves very much as you depicted, as a band of people in possession of a rival faith. And I think for our purposes, and also just for purposes of the truth, the best thing to do is try and make those two groups distinguish themselves. Because secularist progressivism isn't a monolith. Mm. And I do think we can reach in and get some of the people who are not the hardened Leninist-esque leaders of that rival faith. I think a lot of people are up for grabs, is my argument.
There may be something else that we should be pressing, frankly, our bishops for, in terms of the pushback. It's just occurred to me. Where was the Indiana Catholic Conference when Mike Pence caved in on last year? Or the Arizona Catholic Conference when Jan Brewer caved in? Instead of spending the time that they spend on doing all sorts of peripheral things, if we had a rapid response network in every state, operated out of the State Catholic Conference, that by hitting a button sends 500,000 Catholics an email saying, here's, you hit this button and write the governor and telling them, don't you dare cave in to these intolerant promoters of tolerance, we might have a pushback mechanism there. We've got a lot more leverage than we use. And I don't think that necessarily cuts against the living the more nobler lives. You know, we've always said in the pro-life movement that it's service to women as well as legislative philosophical and theological and political science argument. I think it can be a both and thing. But I don't think, I mean, I live in a rather typical suburban Washington area. I've been in the same parish for 31 years. They're wonderful people. Some of them are very good friends. But I would guess that maximum 20% have a sense of the depth of the problem that I'm describing here. Or even 20%, I don't think, max 20% would recognize the legal implications of what happens if Zubik v. Burwell goes the wrong way. We're used to living in a certain comfort zone, Catholics in America, because there really hasn't been anything seriously nasty since the late 19th century. I mean, some of the immigration laws in the 1920s were obviously aimed against us, but it wasn't, I mean, the last kind of burning of stuff and whatnot was the American Progressive Association in the late 19th century. The pushback instinct has been kind of bred out of us over generations. And we're going to have to get that again, and I do think a lot more focus on this from the pulpit, from local bishops, is important and needs to be very seriously considered before the clock really runs out here. And you know, the trends are moving faster than I think any of us imagine. The marriage question was resolved in virtual lightning speed. I mean, it's really quite amazing. So we need pushback mechanisms.
Thank you very much again, George. That was just superb. I'm really grateful again to be here. And just a side comment in terms of, here's my view. Neolistic social liberalism is by its nature a religion, as I said. It's a religion of the state. So the more the churches, Catholic, Christian, and any other God-fearing people are marginalized, it ultimately results in the people being more and more succored by the state. That is the new church. So that's just a side note. In terms of setting directions or changing the directions of, you know, this blessed great country that is the United States, that was and hopefully still is the stalwart of freedom of religion, not freedom from religion, but freedom of religion. You know, I've read studies that have been conducted by different groups all over the country, including the UN and elsewhere, that in order to change the direction of countries that have been ruled by despots and all sorts of crazy types, not just here, but in other parts of the world, studies have concluded that between 200 to 400 high-level bureaucrats in the ruling elites, if they are pushed out and replaced by people of like-mindedness, presumably, you know, or conservative Christian Catholic, then the country will take a new direction. So, you know, we can sort of talk about a groundswell movement, but if the focus ultimately leads to, you know, what we can do to change the elites, and that clearly needs to happen with the conservative government in place. For it. So that's another sort of side comment, and I'll just leave it with one question. So what can we do as Catholics to better embrace the biblical conservative across the broad spectrum in order to build a groundswell of faith-based change across the political, social, and moral spectrum of the U.S.? And what bridges or efforts are currently being made? And my concern is that the socialistic liberals have done a superb job of embracing Machiavellian principles of dividing and conquering.
Well, I mean, we've at First Things for 20 years now, been engaged in a project called Evangelicals and Catholics Together, that, you know, that we continue to pursue, and that has developed a lot of, you know, very useful material on a whole host of the questions that I've described here. But until we get our fellow Catholics, much less our fellow Christians, to understand that voting is not a glandular exercise. It's an exercise of moral reason and prudential judgment. You don't vote with your spleen, you vote with your brain. We've got a big problem here, and we haven't even begun to get that done in the Catholic Church. Where there is still far too much patterns of ethnic voting, old patterns of, you know, my grandfather voted for FDR, so I vote for the Democrats, my grandmother voted for Eisenhower, so I vote with Republicans. That's a big, big, big problem, and that this frankly requires serious social doctrine preaching. I mean, I think many of us complain we don't hear sermons about right to life, about theology of the body. I don't hear sermons about political responsibility. I mean, I've written 1,100 Catholic press columns in the last 20-some years, and that's the only thing that most people see in their diocesan papers around election time. They're not hearing. They're not hearing this challenge to glandularity as a religious challenge. And I think that needs to be raised as well. What was your second point? Because I want to make one comment on that.
In terms of
the top, the tippy top.
Oh, what do you do about that? Well, I think of a couple of very practical things. First of all, Catholic parents can stop buying into the mythology of high-priced higher education and stop wasting $250,000 sending kids to schools where they learn how to be decadent and they learn that there's your truth and my truth, but nothing called the truth. Send your kid to a good Catholic liberal arts school or to a good state school with a serious Catholic campus ministry, and then they can do anything they want. Then they can do the Ivies, Duke, Stanford, whatever. But I have been in two very prominent Catholic prep schools recently, and I am appalled at the parents, obviously well-intended, well-off people, who are still thinking the kid's got to go to Duke. I said, no, read I Am Charlotte Simmons, and then you will get a different idea. This is a myth that we really need to break. Now, I think we're making a lot of progress on the campus ministry front. I think the development of campus ministry in the church in the U.S. has come light years over the last 20 years, and is a real source, should be a real source of pride. Something like Focus, which then extends that vocationally for young people, is very, very good. But I think it's time for the Catholics to stop buying the myth of the high price spread, as we used to call it in advertising in the glorious 1950s. You remember that? What was that? What was that an ad for? Was it margarine? Instead of the high price spread, the high price spread is toxic. And, you know, people need to recognize that. And we have alternatives. I'm going to use one last thing. There are really fine, smaller Catholic institutions of higher learning today. And that's something else we have to develop and protect in this circumstance. Thanks very much. Good to see you all. Thank you.